programs that help improve people or their circumstances. For example, I put on a program about helping women with self-defense, also one on internet dating. One of the things we've done this year is we surveyed our members to see what they're looking for and why they joined the JT. One of the top things that came up is they are looking for leadership development. Now, JC members include Senator Paul Coverdale, Ted Turner, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, U.S. Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Clinton, Larry Byrd, Charles Lindbergh, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, and the former Prime Ministers and Presidents of Australia, France, Denmark, and Taiwan. So obviously, the JCs has a lot to do with leadership. In fact, when our world president was here just last month, someone asked him what the JCs was all about, and he summed it up in one sentence. He said, the JCs is a leadership factory. Basically, we turn out leaders. Now, Mike DiLeonardo, our past president, if you ask him, he says, we don't offer leadership training, but what we do is we offer leadership opportunities. In other words, leadership by doing. So basically, I put this program together tonight to give people, to let people know how we develop leaders in JCI. And I decided to do that by getting some really accomplished, young, professional leaders here who could give you an idea of their backgrounds, how they became leaders, and how you can become leaders too. With that, I would like to welcome Garrett Graveson, founder of HERO, who will talk to us tonight some about his organization and himself.
All right, so this side of the room has on the sunglasses. This side of the room's holding off till the sun gets here. So basically, I think the easiest thing to do, I'm Garrett Graveson, and my co-founder, business partner, Ryan Gambala. We started HERO for Children together, and briefly maybe talk a little bit about what that is and what we do, maybe a little bit on leadership, and then open it up for some questions. Because leadership's such a big term, and exactly what does that mean? I don't think any of us really know, and there's not really one standard answer for that. So you kind of give it your best, and you can go to 100 of these 100 different nights and get 100 different answers. But real quick, Ryan and I started HERO for Children 4 years ago after similar but different experiences in different parts of the world. And I had a chance to live over in Africa and work at an AIDS orphanage in Kenya. And Ryan had a chance to work and spend some time at an AIDS orphanage down in Brazil. And we're like two random white guys that live in Georgia and go to the same school at UGA. We're like, And we ended up at AIDS orphanages in different parts of the world. And my favorite book that I've ever read is The Alchemist. And it's by Paulo Coelho. It's a Brazilian author. And it's one of the best-selling books ever in Brazil. And it basically says, you know, when you want something bad enough, the universe conspires to help you. And it's the story of one guy in his homeland that kind of goes off in search of a journey, only to find out the one thing he was looking for was right back where he started. We both grew up, went to school, high school in Georgia, went to college at UGA, and you never really hear about HIV and AIDS. You hear about it with Bono in Africa and Nelson Mandela, and it's always somewhere else. It's never right here in our own home state. And it took both of us going to two different parts of the world to even realize there was something that we could do here in Georgia for children of our own home state. And when we came back, we realized there are 9,000 kids, 9,000 children in Georgia affected by HIV and AIDS. We had the ninth highest rate of pediatric AIDS in the entire U.S. And there was not one organization specifically focused on their quality of life. And we said, you know what, let's do that. Let's try to be that to these kids here in Georgia. Raise money here in Georgia, try to help kids here in Georgia, and build a platform that could eventually hopefully expand nationally and maybe internationally one day. But then you got to take a step back. How in the world do you get to Africa and Brazil? Why in the world would you ever start a nonprofit? Who does these kind of things? What are you, crazy or weird? Did your parents do this? Like, where did all this stuff come from? And I think a lot of things, it's the biggest tagline or buzzword in business. It's, you know, it comes back to passion. And we were talking about that earlier. But like, what are you passionate about? And not only what you passionate about, what are you actually good at? Because if you're passionate about something and you suck at it, that's not really doing you any good. and if you're really good at something but you hate your job every time you go to it, you're kind of left with a long life to live, right? And so for me, it took a little bit of soul searching to figure out what that was. And it was three separate experiences in three different areas of life that kind of led to jumping on board and saying, you know what, I'm going to try this. And in undergrad, I went to the University of Georgia, and I remember my my girlfriend actually got into Harvard undergrad. And I went there, first semester, freshman year, smartest kids on the planet, you know, supposedly one of the best schools in the nation. And I can talk, if I know a lot of people in this room, and if you know anything about me, I can talk to anybody about anything, or I'll just BS and I'll throw something out there. And something will catch, and then we can talk, and then we'll have a good conversation. Because if you throw enough things out there, something will stick. And I remember going up, first year, first semester, you know, big school in Boston, and I sat there on the top of the library steps at Harvard with my girlfriend, and there were three other people with her. And we went around and we all talked about kind of what we did and who we were. And I think a lot of times society defines who you are as what you do. There's a big mistake in that, but that's what our society does, right? And so the first two kids, when it came to their turn, they made a perfect 1600 on the SAT. I was like, freaking Harvard, bunch of dorks, my God. I was like, well, that's great, 1600, fantastic, my hat's off to you, salute you and all that you've done and accomplished on some standardized test score, which I could care less about. The next guy, he was a Westinghouse winner. To be honest, I didn't even know what that was. I'd never even heard of the Westinghouse. It was the number one science prize in all of America. You get $100,000 as a high school senior to create your invention. 100 grand? Man, that'd be nice right now. I'd drop off at college if I had 100 grand in the bank, much less start an invention. And then it got to my girlfriend, and she was the number one flute player in the entire United States. And she played for the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra as a senior in high school, helping out back up as a flute player. And then it got to the G-man. And for the first time, honestly, in my life, I absolutely had nothing to say. No witty remark, no clever comment, no nothing. And I took a deep breath, just like I take right now, and I was like, man. And I was like, I'm going to let these kids at some good good undergrad school here up in Boston determine, like, because of what they've done, who they are, and how I feel. And I was like, forget about it. I was like, from now on, whatever the heck I want to do, I'm just going to go for it. And I flew back, and I finished my first year in college. And I was like, you know what? Screw it. I always love government stuff, politics. I love all that stuff. Maybe one day run for president of the United States as every little boy wants to when you're growing up. And I said, I'm going to run for student body president as a sophomore at UGA. Youngest person ever tried to do it. Who knows if we win, lose, whatever. 33,000 person school. And we ran. And I made one huge mistake in that campaign. I promised for every single vote that we won by, I would do one push-up. Look at me, I weigh like less than the kids I helped in Africa, and so push-ups for me are not an easy thing to do. And by the grace of God, and I know there is a God up above, because it was the closest vote in student government history in the 225 years our school's ever been there, we won by 58 votes. Thank you, God. And so the next day with the newspaper, I got out there, and man, I probably couldn't even do 59, I swear. But my little arms were shaking, and I got down there, and I did my 58 push-ups. And I said, you know what? It doesn't necessarily make you happy that you've got a big title or that you're a student body president at some big school. And I thought I wanted to do politics, and that really wasn't it. I was like, well, what do I think I want to do? I was like, well, maybe that's big business. Maybe it's make a lot of money, go off and conquer the world and be a billionaire and retire and the next Donald Trump with hot model wife. And that'd still be pretty cool, not going to lie. But and so I had an opportunity. I had never traveled outside the United States, never been anywhere. And the director of our honors program was like, we got the scholarship, you can go wherever, spin the globe halfway around. You know, where would you want to go in a perfect world? And I was like, well, heck, that's exactly what I'd do. I'd spin the globe halfway around, close my eyes, put my finger on it, and see what happens. And it said Hong Kong. I was like, great, do they even speak English there? Is that Chinese? Is that Mandarin? Is that Spanish? Well, it's probably not Spanish. So I'm like, all right. And actually a buddy in the back, we actually worked in Hong Kong together the same time. And I was lucky enough, after getting turned down from one company after another, after another, after another, had a chance to work for Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch. And the way it works for the people that aren't business folks is they have an undergrad analyst program, which is for all the kind of college kids and undergrad. And they have an associate program for all the people between the first and second year MBA school. And she was like, all of our analyst positions are already taken, but we have one spot left And these people are like 31, 32, at Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Dartmouth, Brown, Columbia, NYU, MIT, whatever. You get the picture. I'm like, damn, I went to UGA. I'm 20 years old. And she's like, but I'll still let you interview for it. And the best thing that ever happened was the final question I got that summer, my final interview. Again, thank God I picked the other side of the planet because it was an 18-hour plane flight. And I tell this to my friends, and I'm not even that smart, but I was honest with them when I did it. I bought a Fortune magazine in the airport, and it was like the biggest stock tips of the summer, like one of the five biggest, hottest stocks of the summer. And I'm like, well, hell, I got 18 hours. Might as well read this whole thing. Brrr. My final question that summer, Merrill Lynch, working with like all these, you know, big-time MBA people were, Mr. Graveson, if you pick one stock this summer, you think it'd have the greatest, you know, increase in trajectory, you know, and raise the most over the next 90 days, what would that be and why? Actually, sir, let me tell you exactly what I think about that. And I went into this whole diatribe of nothing that I, and they're like, that's the most impressive answer, you know, we've ever seen. How in the world did you do that? And I'm like, you know what, here's the deal. I was like, that's not my answer, but I got to be honest with you. I was like, I read that on a magazine 18 hours, you know, all the way over here, because here's what happens. People at my school always look at companies like yours. Companies like yours never look at schools like ours. I was like, I could have taken the easy job, rolled the dice, and gone up to New York like everybody else. But instead, I took a chance, came halfway around the world, and I'm sitting in this room today. I didn't know that answer, but I certainly read a magazine. I'll do more work, more research than anybody else here, because all those people have always been told they're leaders. They've always gone to the best schools. These people are always hand-fed everything they've needed. But from the South in a small southern city, we have to work for a lot of the things we get. That's what makes us who we are. That's what builds character. That's what builds leadership. I was like, and that's what I'm willing to do if you give me a chance. And I ended up getting a job that summer. And then I worked 17 hours a day, 6.5 days a week. And I hated it. But it was amazing because I got to see it and I got to prove to myself that once again, it doesn't matter what you've done, it doesn't make you the person you are. And I said, all right, well, I came back. I was about to graduate from school, friends with my buddy Ryan, who is going to talk to you a little bit more about Hero and what he's done. And I said, well, instead of graduating, I always wanted to be graduation speaker. That was my big thing. My mentor 4 years earlier sat inside of a 30,000 person school, a 30,000 person stadium, and gave like the best speech ever. And I was like, I got to figure out what I want to do, where I want to go before graduating. And through an organization that Ryan was president of, I had a chance to go to Africa. And I worked in Kenya at this IT firm, but really it was an opportunity to go volunteer and give back and kind of figure out some of the stuff where no one knew me or my personality or anything I'd ever done, just to kind of get away. And I go to this AIDS orphanage, largest one in Kenya, and I think life is made up of moments. And it's one day, one moment, one kid, his name was Martin. He was 10 years old, and they couldn't say Garrett, and they couldn't pronounce Graveson, so all the kids that day called me Gigi. And all of a sudden, as soon as I said that, these kids were like hanging on my arms, my legs, my neck, were on the monkey bars. I'm like, man, I weigh as much as you do. I can't really carry you on my back, man. And so all these kids were like so cute, so sweet. And as I'm leaving, this one little boy, Martin, tugs at the bottom of my shirt. And he says one thing. He goes, Gigi, Gigi. He goes, everyone says they'll be back. Will you really come back and see us? And I was like, yeah, you know what, I will. And days turned into weeks, and weeks turned into months, and ended up staying that entire next like semester, didn't even come back to school. And that summer was me, Martin, and his best friend, James. And 2 weeks before I left to fly back home, his best friend, his only friend, ended up passing away. You guys hear me? And I think there's something in each and every one of us. And we don't know where it is. Is it from within or like, you know, a land far away? Is it like the natural or the supernatural? Like, what is that? And every single one of us, you want to start a restaurant, you want to start a bar, you want to get married, you want to travel to Italy or Europe or Asia or Africa. Or I've always wanted to do something. I've always wanted to, you know, and people are out there and people are willing to help. But you've got to take that first step. And I think the biggest thing in life with entrepreneurship or leadership is we try to be perfect when instead we just got to get going. We just got to get going. We just got to take one step at a time. And it's not easy. You know, we came back and, you know, we had done a lot of great things in college and had opportunities for some really cool jobs. And a lot of times this stuff is sacrificed too. It's like how much are you willing to put in on the front end to see what can happen in the long haul? One of my favorite quotes is, sacrifice short-term pleasure for long-term gain. Sacrifice short-term pleasure for long-term gain. And that's what we did. We graduated and we moved back in with our parents and we drove our old beat-up cars, which we still have. And that's what it's about, because there's something bigger than in all of us. And whether that's, you know, a business or a love or your next part of your life or a new job or a new career or just getting the heck out there and doing something different, every single person in this room has it inside of them. And chances are every single person in this room, like it or not, may walk out this door, say, interesting speech, and may not make that first step. And I think that's leadership. I think leadership is just saying, I don't know how to do it, I don't know the best way to do it, but I'm at least try to do it. And that's my definition of it.
Garrett, thank you very much. After Ryan talks, I'm going to be asking you guys what you think leadership is. So in the meantime, just be thinking on that a little bit. Right now, Ryan Gambala.
Well, thanks, guys. Let me first just kind of preface my talk. I'm not going to be as I'm not probably going to go as long as Garrett did. I'm a little bit jet lagged. I can't even say it right. I just flew in 3 hours ago from Europe. I was in Croatia, Slovenia. I spent a day in Bosnia and finished up in Italy. And how many of you have been to Europe? Anybody been to any of those countries aside from Italy? Where you been? Yeah? Well, I'm going to put a plug in right now for they're kind of scary sounding, I'm sure, to a lot of you. Croatia, Bosnia, Slovenia, where in the heck are they? Eastern Europe, former Yugoslavia, undiscovered gems, absolute treasures. Put it on your radar. Go back to Wikipedia tonight, to Google Maps, Google Earth, and just Google Croatia images, Slovenia images. And my friend over here, he knows. Ask him later also. Breathtaking. So tonight, I just want to touch on a couple of things. I think if you look at some in Europe, kind of puts this in perspective, you look at a historical, some of the greatest things in this world and some of the most terrible things in this world have happened because of leadership. Atrocities, genocide, the most disgusting things that you can tour museums throughout Eastern Europe or Western Europe or Africa and see that the only reason they were able to go on is because of a leader. A leader who was able to gain power, who was able to inspire folks. You know, there are definite paths, I think, that a leader can take. And a couple of things that I wanted to just kind of throw out there before I tell my brief story is, you know, I think everything in life happens for a reason. I think we're all on a path. I think we're given signs and we're given people that come into your life. You're given experiences that become part of this toolbox that you carry through the rest of your life. My grandfather was a carpenter, and my dad helped him build their house. And my grandfather always used to say that you can only build with what you have in your toolbox. And if all you have is a hammer and some nails, you're going to be pretty limited to what you can build. But if you have an extensive array of tools at your disposal, my, what a mansion you could create. And I think there's a great parallel with leadership. Is if you think leadership is just, hey, I can do one or two things well, and that's going to get me by, I would challenge that. I would say, you know what, you need to be very well-rounded to be a great leader. You look at some of these leaders around the world in history, and I just came back from Europe, so I'm all into history and whatnot. But you see trends that some of the worst leaders were so narrow-minded and so focused on what they thought was right, they failed to acknowledge that there are other points of view and there are other things at play. And I think it is it's important to realize that as you look around Atlanta for things to get involved with, you look for leadership opportunities, look for great organizations like the JCs. I think these are all opportunities for you guys to build and put things in your toolbox that'll help you build a mansion in life. So real quick, What the heck have I done? Why am I up here standing in front of you? I guess I've had a pretty interesting past. I can remember when I was 15 years old coming downtown and not seeing nearly the skyline that we see today. And I came down every day for 17 days for something amazing that a leader of Atlanta had brought to this city. It's called the Olympics, the 1996 Olympic Games. Billy Payne, Andrew Young, Horace Sibley, a bunch of amazing people, just to name a few, were responsible leaders for bringing this to Atlanta. And they had tremendous vision. Nobody ever believed that they could do it. But they said, you know, we don't give a shit what you think. We're going to bring it to Atlanta, and we're going to make this thing awesome. And Coach Vince Dooley is on our board of directors. If you don't know who Coach Vince Dooley is, he is the former athletic director and football coach at Georgia, a god in this state. And Coach Dooley helped Billy Payne bring the Olympics to Atlanta. He was in Tokyo when they were about to make the announcement. And he always tells Gary and I, we were all sitting there so nervous and we were holding hands and no one thought Atlanta could win. No one, everyone thought Billy Payne was a moron. Everyone thought that, how in the world do you think you can bring the Olympics to Atlanta? And he said, you know, I don't care if what you think. Horace Sibley told me, he said, you know what, we didn't add anyone on our committee that thought we couldn't do it. If you were a Debbie Downer and you didn't believe in our dream, and you didn't believe in our passion, then we didn't want you involved because we didn't need that negative energy. It's like Wedding Crashers. I'm an idea man. I don't need negativity. Have you guys seen that? So anyways, it's a great Owen Wilson quote of the movie. But they went all out, and they brought the Olympics to downtown, and I will never forget. I was studying Spanish in high school. I went to St. Pius here in Atlanta, and I was really excited because I figured, hey, all these international folks coming to my city, I'm going to be able to practice my Spanish. And I did. I spoke Spanish at the tennis event over in Stone Mountain to a Mexican tennis player. Oh, I was on cloud nine. I said stuff. He understood me. I thought I was so cool. And I remember meeting an Israeli girl who told me I was so lucky to be an American. I remember meeting a Russian man that taught me how to dance a little Russian jig in exchange for these pins that you could trade in the Olympics. Random things, but they all made a really big impact on me, bigger than I thought. And from that moment, I knew, hey, there's a world out there, and I want to see it. I was on a one track after that moment. I said, okay, I know what I want to do in life. I love business. I was always interested in business. I bought my first stock when I was 13, Home Depot, which did a lot better then than it's doing now, but there's still hope. And I loved business, and then I had this international experience that just opened my eyes to the world, all because of these great leaders of our city. And I said, okay, I'm going to continue studying Spanish. I go to Georgia, and I'm walking around campus looking for international opportunities, and I heard about this organization that had international internships. And I said, okay, where do I sign? This is what I want to do. Well, it was basically like an international monster, where monster.com, not careerbuilder.com on an international level, where you just apply for jobs. Except that the only difference was is this organization called ISAC was a nonprofit. And their goal was that you build leadership skills and you increase your global understanding through this business exchange. So I said, whatever, I just want to work abroad. That was my mindset at the time, and I was very fortunate. I got hired by a Spanish bank, and I went and did banking for a 3-month internship in Spain. I didn't want to work for an American company because I wanted to immerse myself in the language. So I went over 3 months, amazing experience, worked right under the managing director of the bank. It was the second most profitable bank in Spain. It was just eye-opening, dated a Spanish girl, had all kinds of Spanish friends. It was just everything I always wanted. Come back, fluent in Spanish, business internship in banking, international under my belt. I'm like, man, it's on. I'm super excited. I'm starting on my path. Ended up going back to Spain, studying in a Spanish university, directly enrolling like a Spanish student would. 6 more months, almost a year now I've spent in Spain, completely fluent, all kinds of friends over there, great business contacts. My parents were like, all right, go Ryan, you're going to end up with a good job and good salary. And neither of my parents went to college, so this was really exciting for the family. And I was like, yeah, I'm ready. So what's next? I said, hey, I got Spanish under my belt. I want to add another tool to my toolbox. So what about Italian? I started learning Italian. I ended up getting hired by an Italian consulting firm to go work in the island of Sicily for 3 months. Ended up spending a total of about 4.5 months in Italy. Great Italian internship, banking Italian, banking in Spain, Italian, consulting in Italy, Spanish and Italian now. And I said, man, I'm not going to stop. Let's keep going. Bring it on. These romance languages are fun. And I went down to Brazil. Again, business, that was my objective. The Olympics opened my eyes to it all. The languages, the culture, it was just fascinating to me. And I go down to Brazil, and I'm planning on spending some time down there exploring opportunities. And I'll never forget, I was hanging out at a bar in Brazil. And my friends down there, these locals, were talking about all different kinds of things, like casual conversation in a bar. And AIDS came up. I thought to myself, when have I ever had a casual conversation about AIDS in my life? Especially over drinks. Never. And they started talking about AIDS in Brazil. And I was quiet. Like, Garrett had that quiet moment where he didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to say. I never talked about AIDS. I never seen AIDS. AIDS in Georgia? AIDS isn't in Georgia. AIDS is in Africa. AIDS is in other parts of the world. Apparently, AIDS is in Brazil. And they said, Ryan, have you never seen anyone with AIDS? Have you ever seen a child with AIDS? I said, no. And they said, would you want to? I said, sure. So we made plans to go visit an orphanage and spend some time with children who lost everything because of the disease. And I knew if I was going to go do that, and I know kids and I love kids, I didn't want to go empty-handed. And so I took three things that I loved as a child. I took chocolate, balloons, and bubbles. And I show up with a little bag, and these 20 kids run out, and they're all excited to see the foreigner. And they saw that I had a bag, and they're trying to look into the bag. And I pull out the chocolate, and they smile, and they giggle. They'd seen chocolate before. I'm like, okay, this is going good. I pull out the balloons. They smile, and they giggle. They'd seen balloons before. I'm like, awesome. I'm a big hit. And then I pull out the bubbles for the big finale, expecting smiles and giggles. And all I saw were blank, confused stares. That surely, they just might not be able to see him right. And I unscrewed the top, and I pulled out the little wand, thinking, okay, now you guys are going to go crazy, right? And still nothing, absolutely nothing. And then I started blowing bubbles, and their little eyes lit up like Christmas tree lights on a tree. And the next 2 hours we spent blowing bubbles and chasing bubbles and squashing bubbles and playing with bubbles. They had never, ever seen bubbles before that day. That one experience made me realize that this disease that I had never experienced before, never knew anyone that had been impacted by it, can take everything away from a child, their mom, their dad, their health, and any chance they'd have to be a normal kid. Experience things like bubbles. So Garrett kind of touched on Hero for Children and what we do, but that experience made me realize that, man, not everyone's as lucky as we are in life. And I think everything up until then had brought me to that point. Had it not been the Olympics that opened my eyes to the world, had it not been Spain, I wouldn't have gone to Italy. Had I not gone to Italy, I wouldn't have gone to Brazil. And it was a cause and effect kind of thing. Had I not done one, the other wouldn't have happened. And so I realized, looking back, that I was meant to be at this place at this time and to have a friend like Garrett that had a similar experience. And we said, damn it, let's figure out if there are children like the ones we'd seen abroad here and if they have a need that we can try to fill. So our business minds kind of clicked in and we said, okay, if we're going to be leaders, it's going to be because there is a need for us to be leaders in this cause. And there was. 9,000 kids affected by AIDS, 9th highest rate of pediatric AIDS. And the kids weren't getting a critical component of care. The kids in Georgia, they were receiving medicine, they were receiving housing, they were receiving food. Basic needs, critically important. But that was pretty much it. Now, we all know, as a child, if you're going to grow and develop and prosper, you need more than just food, housing, and medicine. And that was the gap that we saw, that quality of life care for the kids that we called it. Quality of life. Helping the kids overcome some of the other challenges of AIDS in their lives. So that's kind of the path that I was on. I was on this international business career path, and then this experience in Brazil kind of made me realize that everything in my life was building. I would challenge all of you to think about what's been building in your life. What's brought you here tonight? Is it an article you read about entrepreneurship that got you to move to Atlanta because it's the city of entrepreneurs, that you met somebody that was in the JCs that invited you to come tonight, and you're thinking about this idea to start a company? And what's building for you? If something's building inside, the next step is to overcome that fear that's keeping you where you're comfortable. It's scary to step out on the limb. Like Garrett was talking, it's scary to take that first step. But that's what you got to do. That's what you have to do. And it's only going to work, and I know Wes is going to talk about this also, it's only going to work if you 100% commit to it. 100%. You cannot just say, oh, I'm gonna dabble in this passion of mine to start this company or to go out on this endeavor. You got to go for it, 110%. When Garrett and I started Hero, no money in the bank, no contacts in Atlanta, no programs for kids with AIDS, no reputation, no credibility. We had nothing. And here 4 years later, we work with some of the biggest people in Georgia, the Miss Universe organization, Chris Tucker, Paula Deen, Vince Dooley, Mark Rick, Paul Hewitt, hundreds of kids, because we took that leap. And people will get behind you. People follow leaders, obviously. And they only follow leaders that have a passion and that really believe in what they're doing. And if you can see it in their eyes that they're convicted, that they're supposed to be where they are leading you at this moment, then it'll all fall into place. So I hope that's made some sort of sense. I'm so jet lagged, it's ridiculous. But thank you, Ben, for organizing this tonight. And thank you guys for listening.
Ryan, that's great. Now, tonight's about leadership, but if you ask people what leadership is, I think a lot of people would have different definitions or they wouldn't really know what to say. So what I want to ask to the audience is just throw out some answers. You know, what's leadership? What defines someone who is a leader? Having a vision. That's great. You know, you can't lead if you don't know where you're going to take people. Anything else? Yeah, you have to be able to communicate. You know, a lot of times that's going to be talking to people. You have to be able to get up in front of people. You have to communicate through the written word. Anything else? So you have to image yourself or learn from other leaders, figure out what they've done, and do it yourself. So you have to have a good brand. Anything else? Yeah, you have to take risks. You just heard from these guys. They knew what they wanted to do, but they had no idea how they were going to do it. But they still have. You have to have the conviction and know you're going to get it done somehow. And I think these, go ahead. Absolutely. You know, no one is a Superman. You all have your weaknesses, and you need to figure out where you can compensate and get those other people to fill in for you. You know, I think if you ask any leader what makes them successful, one of the things they're going to point to is the team that they've built up who can help them, and they have that knowledge. And I think these guys have become leaders because they're really passionate about something, but they also realize that they couldn't do it alone. And that sort of forced them to be leaders. A lot of people aren't really leaders by choice, but leaders by necessity. Okay, that's great. I want you to welcome Wes Moss, financial advisor with UBS, author, and star of The Apprentice.
Okay. Hey, guys. I'm Wes. And I wanted to... I feel as though Garrett and Ryan already stole everything I was going to talk about tonight. So what I've done is I've actually put together a compilation of what they talked about, and I've outlined it in this book. The book's called Starting from Scratch, Secrets from 21 Ordinary People Who Made the Entrepreneurial Leap. And Donald Trump seems to like it, but quite frankly, I haven't seen many products that he isn't endorsing right now. I was at Atlantic Mall this weekend with my wife, and I went past Sharper Image, and there was a picture of Trump and a box of steaks. And he was like, you know, it's Trump steaks now. And my wife just said, oh, my God, I hate that guy. So I have nothing bad to say about this man, but he really has had somewhat of an influence on my life. And I have about an hour presentation that I do all the time, and I really do outline a lot of the things that these two talked about. So I'm going to try to touch on a few things that they didn't talk about and tell a little bit about my story. When I do speaking, I usually really don't tell my story all that much because it's I deal in a world of such successful people as a financial advisor. My clients are people that sold businesses for $5 million and $10 million and $20 million and $30 million. And I work with these guys who work with Vince Dooley, who's got a national championship. So it feels sometimes tough to be in the league of, you know, look, this is a guy, Wes Moss, a guy that you know because I was on a TV show. I mean, big deal, right? And I got fired from that TV show, not to mention. So I had somewhat of a void when I first got off The Apprentice to say, well, what am I going to teach the world as people come and ask me to speak? I don't want to just talk about the show that I was on. So tonight I'll talk about something completely different than I talk about in my talks and tell a little bit about the journey that I've been on and the journey of everything that, you know, mine's almost a journey of accomplishing things that people told me that I could not do time after time after time. And I almost wonder if that's why I'm here today. My relentlessness or passion to do things that people tell me I would never be able to accomplish. So maybe that's where I'll start with, again, your definition of entrepreneurship. If you had to come up with one or two words, what would you say the definition is? Or what would the number one characteristic of being an entrepreneur? And I missed it if somebody had already said it, but we probably said what? Risk, reward, responsibility. Some people like to say greed, possibly. But really, to me, it comes back to ownership of anything bad that happens in your business or your career, and then everything that may be good that happens. So it's the upside. So you own the upside and you own the downside. So really, that comes back to one word for me. It's about ownership. Ownership of your future, ownership of your career, ownership of any direction that you choose to go. And that's what Garrett and Ryan have already touched on tonight. That's really been our focus. How many people here are in the corporate world? You're a W-2 employee. And then are the rest of people own their own business? So we have some people that are just plain unemployed at this point. And then how many people, maybe one day, if you don't already own your own company, would maybe one day want to own a company? A lot of us, it's most of America, would like to do that if we could figure out how to make it work. And how many people want to quit tomorrow, maybe, and start their own company as a possibility? Yeah, you would. Your boss is sitting right behind you, but appreciate it. So we all want to take ownership. So my quest has been to figure out how to accomplish that, and I've just kind of been a study of entrepreneur. I've been studying entrepreneurship for years now, and I ended up writing a book about it. The my story, and I'll tell this, and then I'm going to tell just two entrepreneurial stories that I wrote about, and I'll briefly tell you about how I've used my business principles, and then we'll be done. I always get the question, you know, what did you learn from Donald Trump? Is the number one thing I always get. And I always tell people, you know, I've learned from this man how to maintain the perfect head of hair, number one. He actually, the only true advice he ever gave me was get a prenup, Wes. That's truly one of his top 10 business tips is to get a prenup. But I had been married about 6 months before I left to go on The Apprentice, so I was too late for that one. And that is one that really chaps my wife's, you know, she can't stand Trump because of that. But it comes back to, if you really think about the core of what he does, is that his business is not revolved around smoke and mirrors. The core of what he does is real estate. That's where he's made his money. He's lost a lot of money in it too, but that's why he's a billionaire. And that's what people know him for. And in New York, if you ever live in or stay in one of his buildings or stay in one of his hotels, it's known as some of the best real estate in the city. So he actually has something to back up his mantra. I mean, is he the richest guy in the world? No, you would think he's richer than the entire Fortune 400 list combined. But he ranks in there somewhere around number 100, 150. But you'd think he's number one. But he told what you come... For what you learn after you leave the experience that I went through up in New York for 2 months is that you learn the power of the media, and you learn the power of being different and differentiating yourself and having some sort of product that backs it up. And that's what Trump has always had, and he always will have because he has two brands that really work. One is his real estate, and one is a TV show that's been a pioneer in advertising and product integration that no one can deny. The first season of the show, there were 43 million people that watched the finale alone. I mean, that's almost like American Idol. But can you imagine going on that show? My God. The ratings have dropped, but he has still maintained an income flow for that show. I mean, he makes $1 million every episode just from the advertising there. So my thought was that when I left New York, I said, you know, learning from somebody who's a billionaire who already started out as a millionaire is a little bit difficult to relate to. Does anybody know his first transaction, Trump's first big success, what he did? He bought the Commodore Hotel when he was 27 years old for, anyone know the price tag? $100 million when he was 27. That's not really starting from scratch, okay? So my thought was, I'm gonna figure out how what I would call ordinary people who've built really good businesses that maybe are not billionaires but are successful entrepreneurs. So the non-Jeff Bezos of the world who started Amazon, he borrowed his mother and father, his parents' entire retirement fortune to start Amazon. It happened to work out. But imagine if it hadn't worked out at family reunions. Like, Mom, Dad, I lost every penny you had in this online bookstore, right? Well, so Bezos and Trump and Ted Turner were a little difficult for me to relate to. So I wanted to go around and talk to real people like us here that started out with nothing, essentially, and find out their secrets. And that's what Starting From Scratch is about. That's what this book is about. And I share 21 different stories of people that started out in all sorts of industries. I went to 16 different cities to do this, 21 different industries I profiled. So they're all different industries. And just try to find this common theme. And the common theme, back to the point of tonight, is this: they all have this same mindset. And it's the mindset of an entrepreneur. It's really that simple. And I just call it the entrepreneurial mindset. And it's a mindset of ownership. It's a mindset of action. And I profile this. I break the book down into, starting to sound like an infomercial in the book. You know, like my little sister was telling me the other day. She's like, I want to hang up this poster of your book in my dorm room at Athens so people will buy your book. And I said, you know, that's great. But she's like, you're going to make money off more book sales. And I said, look, I get about 15 cents for every book. So I'm not really, I'm not promoting my book for the sale. I'm promoting it because it's the most fun project and the biggest risk that I ever took in my life to do. And that's what we're here to talk about. So entrepreneurship, about leadership, and the four areas I'll break down. And really, you guys already touched on a lot of them. You talked about them differently, but I break the book down into four sections. I call it The Hunt, H-U-N-T. And it's an easy way to remember everything that these guys said tonight. And the first section is, I call it Harness What You Have. Garrett already talked about that. Ryan already talked about. It's about not just doing what you love, but what you're also good at together. And I'm not going to belabor that because we already know that. The second part of the hunt, I call it underestimate your obstacles. Winston Churchill said that a pessimist is someone that sees the difficulty in every opportunity, and an optimist is someone that sees the opportunity in every difficulty. And we know that there's two kinds of people, and in the entrepreneurial world, there are two kinds of people. In life, in business, in relationships, it seems, there's can-do and there's can't-do people. And you can think immediately, when I say there's somebody who's a can't-do person, you immediately can think of that. And I just call it I actually talk about the tale of two interns. Come on in. Come on in, guys. You guys here for JC's? Oh, cool. Okay. I call it the tale of two interns. So you've got one intern who will, as soon as you ask a question, well, in my office, the mail goes out at 4 o'clock. And if it's 3:55, the can't-do intern will say, you know, hey, we get the mail done. You know, oh, sorry it's so late. You know, do you think we can still get this out? And intern A, let's say, says, it's 3:55. And there's no way. We missed it. And then there's the other intern that it's 4:10 or 4:15 and I come up with something to mail out. And I say, we completely missed the mail. Do you think there's any way we can get this out? And the kid will grab the package, and he'll run up 15 flights of stairs at the top of the building. And you guys have seen this commercial. I know this. And he'll look over the edge of the building and find the UPS truck and jump off and land on the UPS truck and give him the package, come back all sweaty, mission accomplished. Those are the two types of people in the world. The people that you give them an idea, they immediately come up and give you 15 reasons or 100 reasons why it can work. And then there's the other person that you give them an idea, and immediately they say, that's a stupid idea. That'll never work. So because Sarah Blakely's not here tonight, I saw on the when you're signing in here, Sarah Blakely cannot be here at the JCs because she's too big time, I think is what it said. In her defense, she is getting to be relatively humongous, but we'll talk about that in a second. Sarah, actually, this is directly from one of her talks that we talked about on the phone the other day, so I'll pay tribute to her. But she said, Wes, there's no such thing as a stupid idea. There's just no such thing as a stupid idea. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, think about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Think about that as a seemingly stupid idea, but it's a billion-dollar industry now. So that there's really no such thing as a stupid idea. Can anybody give me an idea that they've had or for a business or a product or a service over the last 10 years? Can anybody think of anything they've come up with? Well, maybe that is a stupid idea. I don't know. but anyway, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. That's not at all. But my point is that anytime we come up with any idea, 9 times out of 10, our outside world tells us that they don't think it can work. So Sarah will tell you, and this is how she overcame it. Entrepreneurs are people that literally figure out that there is no such thing as an obstacle, and there's no such thing as a wall, or there's nothing that they can't overcome or go around. There's no problem they can't fix. How many people know Blakely's story, by the way? Everybody? Not everybody, anyway. Long story short, she's selling fax machines door to door. She's got $5,000 in the bank, and she wants to make pantyhose with no feet. That's what she wanted to do. And everyone around her she knew would say, there's no way you're going to make any money. The hosiery business has been dying for 15 years. You'll get eaten alive by all the big players, even if you do get it off the ground. So what did she do? She told no one for an entire year. She did everything by herself. She wrote a patent, paid an attorney a couple $100 to help her actually write the patent, got the product manufactured. All this took about a year and a half. Still told no one. Today, Spanx is about $150 million in revenue. It's probably going to be one of the largest companies in Georgia. Sarah probably won't be one of the richest ladies in Georgia, one of the richest people, period, in Georgia. And her secret to success, as she'll tell you, is to keep things a secret. Not because you have to worry about people going out and stealing your ideas. That's not it. The reason she says keep it a secret, and in her case, is to overcome that obstacle of the outside world coming and telling you can't do it. Happens all the time. 3.5 years ago, when The Apprentice was a big show and the first season was on, and I thought that it may be a good idea to try out, I went and I tried out, just like everybody else did. And I was lucky enough to get one call back, and then another, and another, and another. And there became a point where I said, you know what, this actually may happen. Because in the beginning, I thought that there was just absolutely no chance. But I woke up in the middle of the night one night, I think a couple days before this tape had been due, because I remember looking on the website and it said, turn your tape by this point or come to this audition. And I remember waking up saying, if I don't at least try or swing at this, if at least I'm going to just kick myself forever. So I tried. I kept going interview to interview to interview. And I remember as it started to become a little, the rumor kind of leaked out at my office that, oh, Wes tried out for The Apprentice. Oh, he actually, supposedly he may actually be getting through this process and it may actually happen. And I remember going out to lunch and I had, it was one of these big stuffy broker lunches with a bunch of guys in suits and like me and talking about, you know, international finance. And after the lunch, I remember walking back and having a couple people say, look, I heard you're not trying out for that show. Yeah, you're crazy. That'd be the stupidest thing in the world to go on a reality TV show in our business. UBS, you and us, you know, the Union Bank of Switzerland. And I had another person tell me, you'll never get another client again if you go on a reality TV show. You'll probably lose all the clients that you currently have if you go on a reality TV show. So that's what is that coming? Where did it come from? I don't know. Maybe there's a little jealousy there. Just like when somebody tells you it's a stupid idea, maybe they really say, God, I wish I thought of that idea. So fast forward 4 years now, or 3 years now, and Donald Trump is one of my biggest clients. Real life. Never, ever in a million years could have thought that would have happened. But going up there and going through that opened my eyes to say that there are bigger things that I could do. And there's bigger ways that I can expand my business. And the belief in that is what has got me to the point where I am today, which is extraordinarily different than where I was 4 years ago in business and really in just what I've learned. So I'll skip the third step in the hunt, H-U-N, is to notice your network. And you all touched on that already, where it's kind of that leverage of the outside world, not just inside, but the leverage of the outside world to figure out how that we could, like your incubator, your acceleration program, the Georgia Entrepreneurship Acceleration Program. It's like entrepreneurship on steroids. It's a built-in network to help you grow your business that entrepreneurs need to succeed. And then the last step that both Garen and Ryan already touched on is to take the first step. And I'll leave you with this story. I found one of my entrepreneurs is in San Francisco. His name is Giovanni, this little guy. You guys have met him in L.A., I think. This fellow's name, Giovanni, he's 4'11". He was from Colombia, didn't speak any English, and started as a busboy at just a little Mexican restaurant in San Diego, or in San Francisco. And he kind of worked his way, a lot of energy, this guy. This little guy, a lot of energy, a lot of fun. And he worked his way up from a busboy to a waiter, to eventually being the maitre d', to becoming, you know, kind of like the manager of the restaurant. Manager of the restaurant. And eventually he said, you know, about 3 or 4 years into it, he said, I really think I can run my own company, but I have no, my own restaurant, but I have no money. But I know I can do it. So I know it so deep in my heart, and I have so much energy towards this. I know that I can do it, but I just need to get the money. So his belief was so strong that he could make it work that he went around to literally customers in the restaurant and said, hey, you know, do you think you could lend me some money to start a restaurant? And he convinced 10 different people to give him $5,000. $5,000 is not that. $5,000 is not going to make or break anybody, but it's also not going to help you start a restaurant. So he said, well, $5,000, so somebody can lend me $5,000, but it's not going to do me anything. So he said, maybe I need 10 different people to do it. So he got $50,000 startup capital. Then he went to the bank, which started to take him seriously now that he had $50,000. And he got the other 50 that he needed to get a restaurant going. And he became locally famous in San Francisco for his little Mexican restaurants. And he opened several of them where he served margaritas. And his margaritas became the best margaritas in San Francisco. They kept winning the award, best of San Francisco, best of San Francisco. And he said, you know, I'm the margarita king, this guy, right? So he, .com came around, the bubble came around, we know when the bubble came, but right before the bubble burst, rents in San Francisco became astronomical. Today in Atlanta, you get a nice office space or restaurant space for $25 a square foot. Gio's restaurant was at one point profitable because his rent was $30, $40 a square foot. His new landlord came in, some guy that sold a company for $400 million, and he quintupled the rent. I mean, it went from $30 a square foot to $120 a square foot. And Gio said, I just can't make enough money to cover my rent to selling salty margaritas and corn chips. So he got out of the business, and he said, he'd already done relatively well. Not a multimillionaire. She wouldn't really tell me how much money he'd made, but he'd done well. And he took a little time off. He said, what am I going to do? What's my next venture going to be? And he decided, he said, look, I'm good at margaritas. He said, I think I'm going to start selling just margaritas. So he came up with a name for his company. He called it the Margarita King. Then he changed the name on his license plate, or his last name, to the Margarita King. So his license literally says Giovanni, the Margarita King. And I said, Gio, you ever been pulled over in Georgia? You imagine the state trooper, big hat, come down, and this guy pull over little Gio, and he pulls out his license, Mr. Margarita King, can you step out of the car for me? Talk about a commitment to his brand and to his business. So here we are, a couple years into it, he's getting a little momentum. Basically, his product is bottled margarita mix with the tequila in it. So it's a combination liquor drink. And really tough to get distribution on these things. It's, you know, they've got these huge companies that own all the brands together that pay big money to get in these stores. So a little mom and pop, it's really difficult to get any sort of distribution. Forget if people liked it or not, it's just plain hard to get on the shelf. So he went door to door to door for a year and a half, just knocking on little liquor stores, little local liquor stores. And they all said, sure, it's fine, you can sell your product here. But he never got any distribution. He said, if this company is going to work, I need mass distribution. So none of the distributors would call him back in the state of Georgia. None of them, because he's just this little mom and pop. So he said, I'm just going to go and knock on the doors until I can get something, and still nobody meet with him. So he went to the second largest distributor in the state of California, allowed him, I guess, to come and sit in the lobby. And he sat in the lobby and said, I'm here to see the president of distribution. And they said, look, the president's busy all day. And he said, well, I'm just going to sit here all day until he sees me. So he sat at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, all day long until it was about 4 o'clock. And the secretary said, look, okay, Mr. Margarita King, if you've waited here all day, the president will see you, but you only have 5 minutes. And the deal is if he doesn't like your product, you have to go. No more questions, no more calls. He said, fine. So he takes his little margarita drink in. He gets his 5 minutes. And I've tasted it. It's pretty syrupy, to be honest with you. It's pretty sweet. And he takes it in. An hour and a half later, Giovanni comes out of the office with a deal for this company to distribute his product to the entire state of California. What's the moral of that story? What's the business lesson? Get your clients drunk. That's exactly what he did. Now, the lesson is to continue knocking on doors. And this is a guy who's already had been successful selling margaritas out of the back seat of his car that said, look, I need, in order to make this company work that I believe in, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to make it work. And so those are that's how my book is divided up. It's divided up into these four sections. And this is this HUNT acronym, it's simple, it's easy to remember, and it's something I really live by constantly. And Gio's story hits home with me because I look at going back to the show that people said, you know what, Wes, you'll never do it. You'll lose all your clients. Well, that didn't happen. My business is actually, I would say, tripled, almost quadrupled in the 4 year or the 3.5 to 4 years since I did it. Not to mention, I was lucky to get Trump as a client. I was able to write this book, which again, was not something that somebody came to me to do. It was something that I proactively did and shopped out to different publishers to get a deal. I've got another book coming out in 2007 called Entrepreneurship Undercover. It's published by the Financial Times, Prentice Hall. The WXIA, the NBC affiliate here in Atlanta, turned Starting From Scratch into a little TV segment that I did for a while. And in a couple weeks here, I'm starting a radio show called Real Money. On WGST that goes back to exactly what I've always done in financial planning. Is it going to be an exciting show on Sundays about financial planning? Probably not. But it'd be nice if everyone tuned in. What time? It's going to be 11 to 12 on Sundays on 640 Braves radio station. And it's going to be the competing show. There's one other financial show right now in Atlanta. It's on 750 with Mike Cavanaugh, who's been doing it for 17 years. So there's not going to be a lot of publicity in the beginning because it's going to probably suck for the first couple months before I get my to figure out actually how to do it. But after I get my sea legs, I'll be happy to promote it. So it's not even on yet. But you know, so I live by all this. You know, I live by underestimating my obstacles and trying to leverage the outside world and, you know, taking steps to get these things done. And that's my story, which I usually never tell. It feels weird to tell your own story, but